the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear a blockbuster, an hour-long interview with Gareth Porter, the historian and journalist. This is the audio from a live television broadcast we did recently. It's based on his new book, Manufactured Crisis, the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare. And with history and context, Porter shows how for more than 20 years the U.S. and Israel have portrayed Iran as about to develop a nuclear weapon, despite any real evidence to support that. It's quite a conversation, and I'm glad you're going to listen to it. I want to thank the people who've made this possible by their subscriptions. Andy Betmanis, Terry Paris, and Don Sisney, they're monthly subscribers, and I'd like you to join them. Go to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, follow the link that says Sign Up. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription, brings you bonus items like the rockin' CD by John Dist called Red Flag, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. The other way you can support our work is to follow the link to audible.com from the banner ad on my website. And if you sign up for their free 30-day trial, you get a free audiobook download. You can cancel and not owe them anything, but they'll send me $15 for referring you to try out audible.com. Check it out. It's a great way to help support this program. Good evening. And welcome to this live special broadcast originating from the Marin Community Media Center. I'm Peter B. Collins. My guest this hour is Gareth Porter, journalist and historian specializing in national security policy. He's written extensively about the Vietnam War and served as a bureau chief in Saigon. In recent years, for my podcast and radio broadcasts, I've relied on his independent, critical coverage of our wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it's on Iran and its nuclear program that Gareth has provided expert reporting and commentary in the past few years. He was the 2012 winner of the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism, which is awarded annually by the Frontline Club in London to acknowledge reporting that exposes propaganda. In his new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, Gareth Porter provides much-needed history and context for the current historic negotiations with Iran and a group of nations led by the U.S. And he details how a series of American and Israeli administrations have escalated tensions with Iran and imposed sanctions over an alleged nuclear weapons program that was most likely suspended in 2003. Gareth Porter, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on, Peter. Very nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here in the Bay Area on your book tour. I know you've made quite a few appearances here, and I'm glad to have you here in Marin County. And I want to underscore for our viewers that this is a live program, and you are invited to submit comments and questions throughout this hour. And the address is peter@peterbcollins.com. You'll see it occasionally on the screen during this hour. And we welcome your participation. And I just want to stress that even if you disagree with us, we would encourage you to submit your comments and questions to make it a lively exchange. Gareth, you've been focused on U.S. policy toward Iran for a long time. Today, what do you think is the biggest misconception that Americans have about Iran and its intentions?
Well, that's a very easy one for me to answer, because it is indeed the main theme of my book, that Americans, as well as people abroad, outside the United States, have been misled systematically for many years about the nature of the nuclear program in Iran. And the nature of that propaganda, I think it's fair to say, is that it's a combination of misperception, political bias on the part of early administrations, beginning with particularly the Clinton administration in the United States, but then escalated by the Bush administration in the form of a very deliberate campaign to establish in the minds of Americans, and indeed the views of foreign governments and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA,
right,
the idea that Iran was a threat to obtain nuclear weapons. And it's that part of it that I spend most of the book focusing on. And what I describe in that part of the book is an effort which was initiated by the neoconservatives in the Bush administration to promote a specific charge that Iran was carrying out a covert nuclear weapons program. That began in 2004 specifically. It was John Bolton, the then Undersecretary of State, who personally took charge of this in the administration and was trying to put out the idea that Iran was in fact testing nuclear weapons at a series of facilities at the Parchin military base in Iran. And so that was, as I then go on to show in the book, that was the beginning of a much bigger plan, which involved the Israelis. And it involved what is really the main aspect of this campaign to accuse the Iranians of having a covert nuclear weapons program, which was a set of documents which surfaced in 2004, a few months after John Bolton first surfaced this idea through the IAEA, tried to get the IAEA to put out reports saying that Iran, in fact, was suspected of carrying out nuclear tests at this place in Parchin. So that's really the guts of my book, is how the Israelis secretly propounded a set of documents which were then presented to the world through the IAEA as ironclad evidence that Iran had been carrying out a secret nuclear weapons program. So, in short, really the essence of the misinformation and disinformation that has really been very, very successful in this country and in the world has been to propound a false intelligence case, and very much like, in some ways, the false intelligence case that was made over the Iraqi alleged WMD, mm-hmm, to pave the way for war against Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And as we look at this, Gareth, one of the things that I keep hearing as the talking point that has become a meme is Iran cannot be permitted to develop a nuclear weapon. And it presents a series of false choices, in my opinion, because I do understand the concern about Iran developing that capability. But we ignore that Iran has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and I'll ask you a little later if it has honored that at all times. But the other major power in the region is Israel, which is not signed to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and which is, on a wink and a nod, known to possess an arsenal of nuclear weapons. So to me, that fundamental statement that appears to drive a lot of these simplistic arguments about Iran is false from its origins.
Well, I think you're right that the framing of this issue is wrong from the beginning. And one of the ways in which I address this false frame, if you will, about the Iranian nuclear program is to go back to the origins of the program as it was originally conceived by the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1981, when they resumed the nuclear program that the Shah had originally, of course, constructed. A very, very ambitious nuclear program, by the way, which envisioned 23 nuclear power stations. That's a very ambitious plan that requires enormous amounts of enriched uranium. Now, what the Islamic Republic had in mind originally was a very, very small program, which would have only one power station, and that was Bushehr, the one that Iran had already invested billions of dollars in, at least, I think it was at least $3 billion, if I remember correctly, before the Iran-Iraq war began. And that Bushehr reactor was bombed by Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. And what they wanted to do was simply to have that one reactor and not actually enrich uranium themselves. So I tell the story about how the Reagan administration almost immediately, within 2 years, began to intervene politically and diplomatically with European states, specifically Germany and France, as well as with the IAEA, to prevent Iran from really being able to carry out even that very simple and quite unambitious, by comparison with the Shah's plan, nuclear program, civilian nuclear program for nuclear, for electric power. So the result of that intervention, which was not based on the accusation, by the way, that Iran was planning to get nuclear weapons. They had absolutely no reason to believe that, and they said so at the time. It was simply a power move by the United States to try to weaken Iran without any real strategic thinking associated with it, and it violated Iran's rights under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, because they had absolute right to have a nuclear program, and even to enrich uranium, which they weren't planning to do. So I think that this fact is simply not understood, because it has been erased from the history of the Iranian nuclear issue. We begin the history that has been accepted by the news media and is familiar now to virtually everybody who reads their newspapers. We know from that Iran began to secretly start an enrichment program in the 1980s. And ever since then, you know, they have been suspected of trying to get nuclear weapons. But what has not been understood, what has not been said in the media coverage and in official statements, is that the Iranians were responding to the American effort to prevent them from even carrying out a program that would rely on Europeans to give them the fuel plates for Bushehr.
We're talking with Gareth Porter, and he's with us here live for this entire hour. You're invited to join us by email, send in a comment or a question, and we'll be getting to those in about 10 minutes or so. So please send them in now, and we'll involve you as much as we can in this conversation. One of the things that really interested me, Gareth, and I appreciate the history that you recap in the book, and it's not dense. I want people to know this is a very accessible book. But you take us back to the era of the Shah and the U.S. promotion of nuclear power. We had Westinghouse and General Electric vying for the contracts to get that business from Iran under the brutal dictator known as the Shah. Then in 1979, the revolution occurred. Ayatollah Khomeini returns from Paris. And as you describe, there were some modest efforts while he was ruling the country. Then he died in 1989, and Ayatollah Khamenei took over. And one of the key things that you comment on is the nature of the Iran-Iraq War, which was roughly 80 to 88, and the fact that the United States knew that Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons. And in fact, we provided intelligence to help Iraq target certain facilities and troop movements in Iran. And remarkably, Ayatollah Khamenei used that as a learning experience because Khomeini did not respond in kind with weapons of mass destruction, particularly chemical weapons. And then Khamenei used that as a teaching experience and extended his fatwa to include nuclear weapons. And this history of the religious opposition to weapons of mass destruction on the part of leaders of Iran goes back essentially to the revolution in 79.
Right, and I'm glad you've raised this because I find that this is an absolutely crucial episode in the history of this whole question, the whole issue of weapons of mass destruction as it relates to Iran. As everyone knows, I mean, the Western news media and governments, led by the United States and Israel, have asserted very confidently that Iran has always wanted to have nuclear weapons, and that they haven't gotten them because they've been restrained. They've been, there have been policies that have succeeded in slowing them down.
Mm-hmm.
What they have covered up is precisely what you have introduced, which is that during the Iran-Iraq War, the Iranians did not retaliate against an eight-year chemical weapons attack, a set of attacks, series of attacks, which were highly costly in, mm-hmm. in human terms to the Iranians. Almost 100,000 people affected seriously by the attacks, and more than 10,000 dead in Iran. The Iranian military certainly wanted to retaliate against the Iraqi attacks, if only to deter them from continuing them,
mm-hmm.
on the grounds that if the Iraqis knew that they would continue to suffer attacks, that would stop it. But as you have suggested, Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the supreme leader during the Iran-Iraq War, said, no, Iran cannot possess, much less use, weapons of mass destruction. Chemical weapons are illicit under Islam. And therefore, Iran never did retaliate. Now, some people have argued, one book has been written acknowledging that Iran did not retaliate, but suggesting that must have been because they were incapable of having a program. Technically, they did not master the technology of making chemical weapons, but that's simply absurd. The fact is that the Iranian chemical sector was, if anything, more highly developed than that of Iraq during mm-hmm. that war. So that clearly is not the reason that they did not retaliate. The only explanation that can possibly be used to show that why they did not retaliate is that there was, in fact, an Islamic restriction, which was insisted upon by the supreme leader, who also is the man who is capable and who, in fact, does make rulings based on Sharia law and his understanding of Islam as a guiding set of principles. So that, I think, is terribly important in understanding the fact that Iran cannot, under a Shia theocracy, if you will,
mm-hmm.
a country that is ruled by Shia Islam, cannot possess, much less use, nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is really an underlying factor that helps to interpret the data, which includes a set of statements, speeches, and so forth for the last 15 to 20 years, consistent statements by high-ranking Iranian officials saying it's not in our interest to have nuclear weapons. And they have given a very sophisticated set of arguments as to why Iran should not have nuclear weapons, not simply because of Islam, but because it would not make Iran more secure.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, would create a lot of problems for Iran.
And would you say that Iran has employed what I think diplomats call constructive ambiguity? After all, I believe that Saddam Hussein felt that he had to bluff the United States, that he had WMD, because he thought it was the best way to keep us from invading. And so has Iran, in your view, ever postured in an ambiguous way? Because after all, they fear an attack from Israel, which is threatened on an almost daily basis. And until we made them stronger by invading and occupying Iraq for a long time, Iran was concerned about being marginalized as a regional power.
Well, I mean, the answer on the basis of all the evidence that I've seen is no. They have not, in fact, tried to do what Saddam Hussein is said to have done, to use constructive ambiguity to somehow hold off the Americans while not really going for nuclear weapons. Instead, I mean, they have done something that is quite distinct from that, and that is that they believed that having a uranium enrichment program, the capability to enrich uranium, and the fact that the West, the United States, and Israel in particular would be very well aware of that, which is, of course, the fact, would be useful. It would be enhancing their security because it would be what is called a latent deterrent. And that's different from constructive ambiguity, which is suggesting or hinting that they did, in fact, mm-hmm. have nuclear weapons or would have nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's sending the signal that they're capable of going to nuclear weapons should the situation absolutely demand that. But specifically, this latent deterrent was simply based on the idea that the knowledge that Iran had the capability to enrich uranium would in itself be a kind of deterrent without actually going for nuclear weapons. And I argue in the book that there is, in fact, reason to believe that that was successful, mm-hmm. because there is evidence that, in fact, discussions within the U.S. government, in particularly 2007, when there was a proposal on the table from Vice President Dick Cheney to attack Iran, one of the arguments against that was that there would be a danger if it, in fact, resulted in a direct attack on Iran by the United States, that it would, in fact, trip a lever and that Iran would potentially go to a decision to get nuclear weapons. So mm-hmm. so I think that there is some degree of sense in that expectation, that having a latent deterrent would be, in effect, you know, having as much deterrent or more deterrent than actually going for nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. You're watching a live broadcast from the Marin Community Media Center, and our guest is Gareth Porter for the remainder of this hour. We invite your comments and questions by email. You can address them to Peter at peterbcollins.com, and as soon as we get some email comments or questions in, we'll add them to the mix here. I also want to take a moment to address our viewers here in Marin County to make sure you know about this important resource called the Community Media Center. Our program tonight is staffed entirely by volunteers, and I'll name them at the end of the broadcast, but I'm very grateful that they are helping us produce this program. And here on Public Access Channel 26, there's a whole range of programs produced by people here at the Media Center that bring you information and different types of content that you won't find in most other places on your huge array of cable channels. So if you're at all interested, I'd like to invite you to explore volunteering here at the Media Center. You can be the media and perhaps create a program of your own. And you probably, if you're watching on Channel 26, I'll tell you that the website is simple. It's cmcm.tv. So drop in, take a look, and feel free to come by the Media Center and check out the facilities and perhaps consider producing your own program. Gareth, there are many characters in this book who appear and then appear again. And I want to single out one on each side. One is Bob Gates. Gates has been a very close associate of the Bush family, going back to when George H.W. Bush was running the CIA. And he was, they attempted to make him director of the CIA, and that attempt failed. He was not confirmed in the late 1980s. Then he was on Bush Sr.'s National Security Council, And then they did succeed in confirming him as director of the CIA. I think it was in 1991.
Correct.
And you explain in the book that this occurred at the same time as the breakup of the Soviet Union, the putative end of the Cold War, and that this put at risk the budgets of defense and intelligence. And voila, Iran was made one of the new boogeymen to justify the lack of a peace dividend at the end of the Cold War. Talk a little bit about the role of Gates and take us through his various iterations up to his appointment as Defense Secretary by Bush and his retention by President Obama.
Right. I mean, Bush really plays a key role in this critical transition period.
I think you mean Gates.
Gates, excuse me. Did I say Bush?
You did.
I did. I'm really sorry. Robert M. Gates, who was, as you point out, Bush's, he became the director of CIA in late 1991, but they tried to promote him earlier to that position. And the critical transition here, as you have suggested, is the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the obvious impact that that would have on the congressional appropriations for the Pentagon, the armed services, and the CIA. And it was not just Gates himself, but his predecessor, Webster, who in fact was there during the time when it was clear the Cold War was going to end, as early as 1988. There were people within the CIA as well as the Pentagon who were looking ahead and saying, look, the game's over, we know that. And they began to figure out what they had to do in order to salvage their Cold War level appropriations. And so Webster actually began the process in 1988 of a whole campaign built around the idea that there are new threats coming on stream that we have to prepare for. And proliferation of weapons of mass destruction was the one that he highlighted. He made a whole series of speeches, unprecedented in the annals of the CIA, for a director to do that. And so Gates was really taking over that propaganda campaign, if you will, and being a bit more sophisticated about it, because what Gates did was to really prepare a set of presentations to the intelligence committees of Congress. And so those are published, of course, and I use them to show, you know, the excerpts from his testimony before the intelligence committees to show that Gates really did not just single out the proliferation of WMD, but pointed to Iran as the single biggest threat in regard to the future of the Middle East, as well as proliferation of WMD. So He very early recognized that Iran was the primary, the poster country, if you will, for this new threat that they counted on, and they treated quite explicitly as the equivalent of the Soviet threat in this testimony before Congress. So it's really quite interesting the way he tried to build a new constituency in Congress for Cold War levels of funding for the CIA to fund the manpower and the programs that had been devoted to the Soviet threat, which now would be devoted to WMD proliferation, particularly nuclear weapons, of course, and Iran being the primary threat. And he set up a new center in late 1991. It was set up just before he became director, and then he reorganized it as soon as he became the director, with the purpose of providing analysis to the policymakers, information and analysis about new programs of WMD in these target countries. Mm-hmm. And thus doing, he created the expectation that Iran and Iraq, as well as other countries, but those two primarily, would in fact be trying to proliferate WMD. And that is the beginning of what I call the intelligence failure on Iran, just as it was on Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the other side, we have Hassan Rouhani. And he has been actively involved in the issues related to the allegations of a nuclear program for many years. And kind of like Gates, he pops up at intervals. And he is now the president of Iran. It appears he was handpicked by the supreme leader, who is able to narrow the field of who gets to run in their elections. And I'm wondering what signal his resurgence was intended to send by the supreme leader.
Well, I'm not sure if I would say that it's the case that the supreme leader was sending a signal by choosing him. I think that, or sort of making it more likely, let's put it that way, that he would be the candidate. I think what he was doing was acknowledging that it was time, that he needed Rouhani, that Rouhani's services were really needed by Iran. So in a sense, maybe he was sending a message to the voters of Iran, and maybe that's what you meant. But clearly, the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, believes that Rouhani is a very talented, very wise strategist. And Rouhani served as the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council of Iran for many years, beginning in 1989. He was handpicked by the then-president Rafsanjani as soon as he took over. But clearly, he gained the total trust of the supreme leader during the period from 1989 to 2005. And I think that's really the key. I mean, what really the significance of Rouhani's rise in this current situation is that the supreme leader really believed in Rouhani, in his ability, particularly as a diplomat, the ability to craft a diplomatic position that would protect the core interests of Iran, but would open up new possibilities for reaching agreement with the United States, because he had shown that in 2003 and 2004 and 2005 during the period when he had charge of the nuclear file. He was specifically chosen by the supreme leader to become the person to coordinate Iran's nuclear policy during that period. Mm-hmm. And he showed that he was capable of very great creativity in crafting a diplomatic position that was aimed at reassuring the West. And I think in that sense, the supreme leader saw that he would be in a position to maximize the ability to have an agreement with the United States, particularly, that would protect the interests of Iran.
Now, the subtitle of your book is The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And it's really interesting to see when you lay out the history of this, that as far back as 1993, Prime Minister Rabin of Israel first predicted that Iran would have a nuclear weapon in 10 years, which would have placed it 2003. But just 2 years later, he had amped up the prediction and the threat, saying that Iran would have a nuke in 5 years, which would put it at 2000. We're still waiting for that prediction to become true. And lately, and just one more look at the book, Netanyahu has used these crude cartoons at the United Nations. And we learned recently that Israel has just approved a $3 billion authorization for strikes on Iran for the current fiscal year. Now, first of all, just on a geopolitical basis, since Israel has its own nuclear arsenal and is a regional power, why is it so concerned about Iran?
Well, that is indeed a primary question for people to ponder and to understand. And in my book, I really devote a great deal of space to that, precisely that question. Going back, as you said, to 1993, when that's really the turning point in Israeli policy, what people need to understand is that until 1993 or late 1992, Israel's policy in the Middle East was one in which Iran, even after the Islamic Revolution, Iran was regarded as less of a problem, less of an enemy than Sunni Arab regimes in the region. And indeed, during the Iran-Iraq War, the Israelis were supporting the Iranians. And of course, the whole Iran-Contra thing began because the Israelis were pushing the Reagan administration to have a little opening to Iran. And the Reagan administration did, in fact, respond with this effort to have a secret visit to Iran and to talk to them about the possibility of a deal, some American arms or arms that would be coming from somewhere else in return for freeing hostages held in Lebanon. That did not happen, but of course we know it turned into later on, a deal that involved the Contras, and therefore it became the Iran-Contra affair. So the point here is that, in fact, the Israeli national security mechanism, the Mossad in particular, and the IDF intelligence people, have never really viewed Iran in the same way that they viewed Iraq, for example, until the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, as a threat to Israel. In fact, they held on to the notion that if we wait around for a while, Iran will return somehow to a policy that will be more friendly to Israel. That's an idea that has never really been given up by many people within the IDF and Mossad. Even apart from that, the idea that Israel would seriously contemplate an attack on Iran, I point out, is not really supported by the facts over a long period of time, over the last 15 years or 20 years. In fact, the evidence very strongly supports the idea that the threats that have been issued directly or indirectly by Israeli governments have been aimed essentially at manipulating the policies of the United States, the Europeans, the Chinese, the Russians, to get them to carry out much stronger anti-Iran policies.
Of course, Israel frequently says that if the U.S. won't support it, they'll go it alone.
Exactly.
And essentially draw us into it anyway.
It's more or less transparent what they've been trying to do, but the fact is the news media, not just in the United States, but throughout the world, have constantly treated these threats as though they were really serious matters that we'd better pay attention to. The implication is unless we really do something, we're going to have a war on our hands, which would be terrible. In fact, if you read the Israeli press, it's quite interesting. There are all kinds of hints and indications from time to time that, in fact, what's going on is that this is really an effort to get the international community, quote unquote, to carry out policies that would be much tougher on Iran, including, of course, the present system of sanctions. I mean, this is what the Israelis really wanted primarily. In 2009, 2010, 2011, when Prime Minister Netanyahu was making sounds as though Israel was contemplating the possibility of an attack on Iran.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we look at the current negotiations with Iran, and they appear to be making significant progress, there was an interim deal, and it appears by all accounts that Iran has observed that. We're moving forward toward a more permanent deal. But Israel and particularly Prime Minister Netanyahu seem bent on disrupting this. And for example, as it appears that a deal is now achievable, Israel in March tried to change the terms beyond nuclear weapons and say, well, we need to make sure that they've been disarmed of missiles that could possibly reach Israel. That's a deal breaker for Iran. And do you believe Israel wants the talks to fail so that they can rationalize a military attack?
Well, there's no question. The Israelis want the talks to fail. I mean, they've hardly made any secret of that. It's really quite transparent in the public position taken by Netanyahu himself, as well as other senior Israeli officials, that they really don't want any deal that wouldn't completely end the capability of Iran to do enrichment. I mean, that they would accept a deal that would essentially end the nuclear program, but that's the only deal that they would find acceptable. Mm-hmm. So virtually everything that they've tried to do over the past few years in terms of their insistence to the Obama administration about the U.S. Diplomatic posture in those talks has been aimed essentially at sabotaging them. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole series of things that the Israelis have insisted on that were clearly aimed at that. And you've named one of them, which was the idea that Iran should be prevented from basically having their missile program. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that's the implication of the language that has been put forward. I don't think that that's really a serious proposal. I don't think the United States expects that there is, in fact, going to be any agreement that deals with the Iranian missile program. But like some other things that have been talked about, these are things that the Israelis clearly were pushing very hard, and there's a tendency for the Obama administration to at least embrace them at first with the intention of perhaps fuzzing it over during the talks that they couldn't push it all the way. And so they would try to have it both ways, essentially.
Gareth, one of the most important books about Israel that I've read in recent years is this one. It's called Goliath, written by an American Jew named Max Blumenthal. And to his credit, Blumenthal moved to Israel and lived there for several years. He was there in 2008-2009 during Operation Cast Lead, the lengthy assault on Gaza. And I highly recommend this book because what Blumenthal does is bring us the voices of a full range of the Jewish population, from the hard right Zionists in the Knesset to those who are actively pushing a much more moderate posture for Israel. Your book notes in several cases that Israel's military and intelligence leaders don't support the extreme positions of the political leadership. And as I mentioned, the Blumenthal book depicts the full range. Do you see any signs of moderation in Israeli politics?
I mean, I'm not an expert on Israeli politics, but certainly everything that I know suggests at this point that the internal politics of Israel are certainly, you know, if you look at a longer term evolution over this, let's say the past 10, 15 years, there is a trend not towards moderation, but towards extremism. I mean, this is a result of, you know, the evolution of Israeli society, the fact that they have had large-scale immigration over the last couple of decades, particularly from Russia, where they've had a settler population growing. The number of people who are really hardcore, people who do not want any kind of agreement with the Palestinians for obvious reasons that it's not in their personal interest, has been growing. And this has resulted in Netanyahu being elected and, you know, the Likud party having a continuous hold on power. That's not to say that there are not deep divisions in Israeli society, because there are, but so far at least, that tendency has been strengthened over a period of years rather than being weakened. So that's my perception.
The extreme voices seem to regularly demagogue issues in ways that marginalize other points of view.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, the voices of peace, you know, the critical voices who really, you know, stand up for justice in Israeli society have been muted, I would think, you know, much more over the last decade than in previous eras.
Blumenthal also offers many depictions of racism in Israel, from Bedouins in the Negev Desert to Arab citizens of Israel to Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. The superior rights of Jews are evident in many ways. And now Avigdor Lieberman is moving to separate populations into what the South Africans called Bantustans, the kind of ethnic cleansing that we object to when we see it in other countries. Why is Israel given deference on policies that fit the definition of apartheid?
Well, of course, this always comes back to domestic politics in the United States and the role that currying favor with Israel, supporting Israel to the point where virtually any criticism of Israeli policy is regarded as somehow a derogation of duty on the part of the White House or the president or of any other politician. That has become the norm in American politics. And this, of course, is enforced by the role that the Israeli lobby plays, particularly with regard to Congress. The deal being that they can get both houses of Congress to pass virtually any piece of legislation or resolution dealing with Israel almost at a moment's notice. Very quickly, they can mobilize a vast majority of members in both houses of Congress. Mm-hmm. That's an unprecedented situation of power for any lobbying group in this country. And it really does distort U.S. policy beyond recognition in terms of any rational basis. It certainly doesn't represent the interests of the American people.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email question that came in, and thank you to our viewers. Feel free to submit a question or a comment to peter@peterbcollins.com. And it's in the form of a question, Gareth. How can we as citizens of the U.S. impact our government officials who are in control of the deployment of actions for what the impact is in Iraq and Iran? I think we have the gist of the question, to stop the financial impact on the U.S. and the risk of a conflict.
Well, if I understand the question, I mean, it's the all-important question, which is how do you bring about change in this political system, which would restrain the United States from taking actions such as it did in Iraq and which were threatened, at least in Iran, and would have taken place, I think it's fair to say, had it not been for the fact that the United States got bogged down in the war in Iraq. That was the intention of the neoconservatives, to attack Iran. So it's certainly a real possibility that could have happened. My answer is that I don't really have sort of an easy formula for bringing about change, because Congress is really very far gone at this point in terms of the power of both the Israeli lobby and the military-industrial complex lobby. I mean, the combination of those two really makes it extremely difficult to promote any reasonable policy that involves the interests of either of those two parties, those two sets of interests. And so that means that, you know, it's really almost necessary for people who have concerns such as the one that are reflected, the ones that are reflected in this viewer's question, that you have to take a much longer view. And I think really education is the first stage of change. And as difficult...
And maybe we should ask people to read your book.
Maybe reading my book would be a starting point, specifically in terms of seeing just how completely information about the arguably the primary national security issue for the past few years, at least it's been promoted as such, has been completely misrepresented and has absolutely completely fooled the American public. And indeed the rest of the world. It has been absolutely a fabulous success in this regard. So really, the education of people about how this system of misinformation through the news media has operated, I think, is really critical to this. And that's really, I think that's the best answer that I can give.
Israel projects an image of military invincibility. And in your book, and this was news to me, you show that Israel isn't actually capable of launching a major attack on Iranian nuclear facilities. There are issues of flyover rights and, more importantly, refueling of the number of jets that it would take to accomplish this. And going back a few years, the 2006 war on Hezbollah showed that Israel is far from invincible. Now, with a military coup in Egypt, a three-year civil war in Syria, the ongoing civil war in Iraq, how can Israel contemplate more conflict in the region?
I don't think it can. I really think that's out of the question. And indeed, I would argue, you know, I think you've adumbrated my answer in this regard, that recent developments, that is developments over the past, you know, decade somewhat less than a decade, have really restrained Israeli power. The freedom of Israel to use military power has been restrained effectively, really, for the first time in many decades. And that's a very, very significant development in Middle Eastern politics. And clearly, Hezbollah and its ability to retaliate and the inability of the Israeli military forces to eliminate that is a critical development in that regard. Now, that, of course, makes developments in Syria all the more critical. And there's no doubt the Israelis very much want to remove the Assad regime right now. So how that plays out is really important in regard to this issue of whether the Israelis can somehow recover a large part, if not all, of the freedom of action to use military force, which is really central to their whole idea of their own power in the region.
And a viewer is asking, do you think Iran and Israel will ever peacefully coexist?
I think that's certainly possible. And indeed, in my book, I point out that in the mid to late 1990s, it was perfectly possible that they could have done that. The Iranian government had not yet gone into production of longer-range missiles, the intermediate-range missiles that could reach Israel. Indeed, they didn't have a missile that could reach Israel at that point. And they were inclined, it appears, to try to reach an accommodation with Israel, even if it was a very simple kind of understanding about live and let live, that neither one would try to achieve first-strike capability against the other. And the Israelis seemed to show no interest in that. Indeed, they sort of toughened up the posture under Netanyahu starting in 1997-98. That was a big mistake for Israel at that point, because I think that they simply kicked away a real opportunity for developing a more stable, peaceful coexistence relationship between Israel and Iran. I think things began to get out of hand after that.
Now, the U.S. media paints Iran as devious and aggressive, but at the same time, the U.S. and Israel collaborated to insert the Stuxnet virus into computers at Iranian nuclear facilities, and I consider that an act of war, just like lobbing missiles or sending in commandos. And we've also seen a series of brazen murders of Iranian scientists, often in broad daylight. We've been running with Israel a covert war on Iran that doesn't get covered in our corporate media. Are there other examples that you'd like to mention of provocative actions by the U.S. and Israel?
Well, I think you've covered the most important ones. Certainly, I think the, the most aggressive, let's say, let's put it that way, certainly have been the Stuxnet attack in 2009 and the assassination of a whole series of scientists in Iran. And I would say, I agree with you, the Stuxnet cyber attack was an act of war, needs to be recognized as such. Certainly the Iranians would have recognized it as such. Of course, the idea was that the Iranians were not supposed to understand who was behind it or what was really going on, that they were supposed to be befuddled by the idea.
And yes, the Vatican.
and that sort of underestimated the ability of the Iranians to figure things out. It also overestimated the ability of the United States and Israel, who were collaborating on that strike, to really do it in a way that would avoid a mistake. They made a big mistake, so that was the problem. But, you know, that certainly was an act of war and a very serious mistake on the part of the United States, because, of course, it invites retaliation at some point of the timing and circumstances of their own choosing by Iran. And I would also say that the whole campaign of sanctions attacking the ability of Iran to sell oil, crude oil, to countries that want to buy the crude oil from Iran is, you know, very much like the U.S. policy before World War II in the Pacific of preventing the Japanese from getting their oil that they needed from the Southeast Asian countries. They're both effectively acts of war, and I think a very serious policy on the part of the United States, which shows just how far the United States is willing to go to trample on what is normally regarded as the right of a country under international law. So I think those are very provocative. They're all provocative policies that are being followed.
We're running close to the end of our broadcast, and I just want to ask you to briefly explain to our listeners the role of the Mujahideen al-Khalq, known as MEK. It's a militant group that was listed as a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department for their operations in Iraq. But when MEK aligns with the U.S. and Israel and becomes a provocateur in Iran, we've seen a range of big players from both parties scrub the history of MEK and advocate for them. And I'll put aside the question of whether that's providing material support to a terrorist group. But MEK also played a role in what you call the Iranian curveball, an episode with a missing laptop computer and a mystery man known just by the last name Doe, an Iranian-born CIA asset. Take a minute and tell us about that.
Well, this is the absolutely central episode in the book, which I discuss at some length, about how the MEK was really the instrument that the Israelis used. Because at that point, we're talking about the period of 2004, 1974. The MEK had already established close relations with Mossad, the Israeli International Spy Agency, and had already been used by the Israelis to launder intelligence that they wanted to make public but did not want to be attributed to Israel. Mm-hmm. And so the MEK was used to surface a set of documents, which I alluded to earlier, which were fabricated by the Israelis, which showed that Iran was purportedly carrying out a covert nuclear weapons program. The MEK turned them over to German intelligence, which then turned them over to the CIA. And for many years, this was all very mysterious. Nobody knew where the papers had come from. Mm-hmm. There was the story, as you've suggested, that these came from a participant in the program itself, from his purloined laptop computer.
Right.
That's why they were sometimes called the laptop documents. Now we know that that was a lie. It was a cover story for mm-hmm. what really happened, which was that the Israelis gave the documents to the MEK. The MEK then gave them to Germans. Germans gave them to the CIA. And they became then, of course, the Bush administration, knowing at least John Bolton, I'm quite convinced, knew mm-hmm. what the Israelis were doing. And he and his allies within the Bush administration helped to push those into the system through the International Atomic Energy Agency. Mm-hmm. So the MEK played a really crucial role in this whole disinformation campaign surrounding the Iranian nuclear program. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the John Doe,
right.
A covert agent of the CIA, working on WMD proliferation, both in Iran and Iraq, a top-level agent of the CIA who was supposed to get one of the most prestigious medals that the CIA had to offer their agents. And he had a high-level, high-confidence source in Iran who told him in 2001 that Iran had no intention of weaponizing, despite the fact that it was enriching uranium, as it was mm-hmm. well known. So this information could have changed the whole intelligence assessment of the U.S. intelligence community about the Iranian nuclear program. Mm-hmm. This would be the first hard evidence from a high-level source within Iran about their nuclear intentions. Instead of circulating this, his bosses in the CIA told him there should not be a written report done on this information. We will personally brief the President of the United States. He found out there was no such briefing, and that information was suppressed. It was never circulated. Mm-hmm. So this is a indication that high-level officials of the CIA did not want very important intelligence to get circulated because they wanted to make sure that the intelligence assessment would continue to say that Iran wanted and was, in fact, actively pursuing nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gareth, there's much more I'd love to talk with you about. We've covered a lot in this conversation. I highly recommend your new book called Manufactured Crisis. I learned a lot from it, and I hope our viewers will find the book, pick it up, and get as much out of it as I did. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter. I appreciate it.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for watching, listening, and participating in this live special broadcast. This program was produced at the Community Media Center of Marin, with thanks to Executive Director Michael Eisenmenger, our producer Richard Alejandro, and our great volunteer crew, Tom McAfee, Jim Garrity, Eric Morey, Cheryl Schurer, and Scott Calhoun. You can read Gareth Porter's dispatches at antiwar.com, and you can listen to my podcasts at peterbcollins.com. Thanks again.